Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Tarita Thomas, MD, PhD, MBA, and Remus Lucas, MD, about abstracts presented during a brain cancer-focused clinical science symposium at the 2024 ASCO annual meeting. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Thomas and Lucas discussed the results of four abstracts presented during the symposium. In particular, their discussion highlighted findings with ST101 in window of opportunity cohorts of patients with recurrent glioblastoma, the prognostic utility of cerebrospinal fluid circulating tumor DNA in recurrent high-grade glioma, the genomic drivers of glioblastoma, and preclinical data with navtemadlin in IDH wild-type glioblastoma.
Hello, my name is Tarita Thomas. I'm a radiation oncologist at Northwestern University.
Hi, my name is Remus Lucas. I'm a neuro-oncologist at Northwestern University.
And we're here to review some of the key updates in CNS oncology with Dr. Lucas. Thank you for taking the time to do that.
Hey, Tarita, thank you for involving me. I'm greatly looking forward to the opportunity to discuss the sessions from the CNS Clinical Science Symposium at ASCO 2024.
Wonderful. So I wanted to get started with the first abstract. The title of the abstract is Efficacy and Biomarker Analysis of a Phase 2 and Window of Opportunity Cohorts of Patients with Recurrent GBM Treated with ST101, an inhibitor of the transcription factor CEBP-beta. If you wouldn't mind giving us just a brief summary of the abstract.
Sure. So this is an abstract presented by Dr. Fabio Iwamoto from Columbia University. It's a multi-center clinical trial which looked at a novel agent, special peptide, which is able to block its target in patients with glioblastoma. What's kind of exciting is that the study had a number of different arms. It had a recurrent disease arm, and then it had two window of opportunity arms, meaning that patients were able to receive the drug, then underwent a surgical resection, and then continued on drug. And the arms were in the newly diagnosed setting and the recurrent disease setting. And what was exciting about this is, in addition to the traditional clinical endpoints, they were able to look at some interesting correlative endpoints as well.
I thought that was a very interesting study design with this window of opportunity cohort. The recurrent GBM patients versus those within this new diagnosis cohort most likely would have very different potential responses. Was that something that you would think the study designers would be concerned about?
No, so I think that the way I would view it is this is an opportunity to see really what's going on. It's an early way to sort out whether the drug is working. And what they were able to demonstrate in this that, yes, the drug does get up into the central nervous system in both situations, so that's good. And then two, the drug is able to engage the target in the central nervous system in both situations, which is also great. And I think, you know, you'll need longer, larger studies to give a hint of whether this is truly efficacious, meaning does this make people live longer, which is the goal that everyone is chasing after. But knowing that you're at least on the right track with regards to getting drug to where it has to get to and having it do what it should be doing is favorable. What's also interesting in the correlative studies that they performed, they were able to demonstrate that there is an immune infiltrate. So you're getting CD8 cells in there, you're getting macrophage shift from the immunosuppressive macrophages into the immunosupportive macrophages, and then you're having peripherally a decrease in the overall Treg count. So shifting things in the way that we would like things to be shifted. And again, whether this makes a difference clinically, who knows? We'll have to find out.
Yeah. So, you know, with the two cohorts, with the recurrent patients versus the naive patients, the progression-free survival and overall survival, though really early results, were different. Can you speak a little bit about that?
You know, I think from my point of view, it's still too early to make sense of whether there is efficacy or not. And I think all of us will look at those types of results within the context of earlier phase clinical trials, but I think we need to take that all with a grain of salt. So I think for me, the big learnings from this are those other elements that are part of the correlative study. And I think part of the clinical trial symposium was trying to hammer home this idea that this stuff does have value. It helps us when we take a look at these things earlier on in drug development.
Sure. No, that's a really exciting abstract. Did the study investigators give us an idea about the phase 3 arms?
No, at this point in time, we don't know that. Okay. What's going to happen next?
Just wanted to follow up with the next abstract, Utility of Circulating tumor DNA from CSF for prognosis of patients with recurrent high-grade glioma.
Yeah. So this is an interesting one that looked at CSF, circulating tumor DNA, as a biomarker for the disease, right? And this is from the Memorial Sloan Kettering group. And what they did is collected samples from a variety of different time points. This is not within the formal construct of a clinical trial, so there's less rigidity with regards to when these samples were taken. Most of them were from lumbar punctures, but some of them were from ventricular taps as well, too. So there is some heterogeneity there. What they're able to demonstrate is that they can pick up certain types of mutations present in the CSF, and then they can, in theory, track those over time, see if those things, happen or don't happen. And I think the other big take home from my perspective was that presence of circulating tumor cell DNA in the CSF was associated with worse outcome, which is not surprising, right? If you have enough tumor that's spilling this out into the cerebral spinal fluid, probably not a good thing.
Yeah, I thought this was a very interesting abstract and really lent itself to moving forward as another way to really identify patients who may have leptomeningeal disease is what the authors talked a little bit about. Wanted to get your thought about the use of their specific paradigm, the MSK impact testing, as the backbone of evaluation of the CSF versus, some of the other types of testing that we have that are clinically available.
As a non-basic scientist, I'm really not as concerned about what specific platform is being used. I think it's, used out of convenience and other sort of a number of different practical factors that weigh into whether it's platform A versus platform B that's utilized. I think for me, it's that bigger concept. And I think this type of an approach has value, as you pointed out, with regards to leptomeningeal disease, including leptomeningeal metastases. And then here in the setting of, gliomas, it can also be used. One of the questions I have is how representative is this of what's going on in the brain itself and in the interstitial fluid around the brain and the patients with these primary sinus tumors? I don't know, and I don't think anybody truly knows at this point in time.
Sometimes imaging can lag behind what is really going on molecularly with the patient. If this goes to the next step, and I know this is kind of the idea of this whole symposium, what are your thoughts about having this come through an academic center like MSK, who started this work, versus some of our other colleagues in industry to get this to the patient quicker?
Oh, yeah. So I think anything to become broadly available, you need the leverage of industry to be able to be successful in scaling something up. So I think that is essential. For me, the way I can see this ideally panning out is having this type of a platform incorporated into future clinical trials where you have these samples at fixed time points to help us get an understanding of what's going on. And it is exciting because it may be able to give us an earlier readout of failure or success than our traditional MRIs, as you were kind of pointing out.
Yeah, very, very interesting study. I wanted to move to the third study in the symposium. Longitudinal tumor-wide sampling of glioblastoma reveals diverse genomic drivers of the earliest clonal expansion at diagnosis and recurrence from investigators at UCSF.
So I think this is a really exciting one where they were able to take tissue samples from a broad anatomic area in a small number of patients over time. And what they were able to show is that there is the collection of abnormalities within the tumor that are these truncal drivers for tumor growth. And those things persist actually over time and over space. What's also interesting is you have clear overgrowth of subclones that may lack some of those drivers and may have new abnormalities that are present at time of progression. So you have this massive overgrowth of this clone and massive overgrowth of that clone, but you still have this small population that persists, indefinitely. And then for me, that raises the question of what do we need to target? Do we need to target that subclone that has evolved? Do we need to target that, original trunk? Or do we have to figure out how to be smart enough to target all of it? I think the other element that was really interesting for me is that these things are geographically widespread. So it's not like you have one little pocket of tumor type A and one little pocket of tumor type B. You have tumor type A all over the place, and you have tumor type B all over the place. So these tumors all know how to get from point A to point B without difficulty. So they all have that skill set.
Mm-hmm. What was interesting, that I actually thought that point was really well made with also their diagrams and their presentations, that this founding clone could be found anywhere in the populations and in the future disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's nice because it ties in with Craig Horbinski's work, and Craig was the one who presented the initial sort of an opening educational component of this session, where he was able to demonstrate that there is this movement of tumor cells over time into the brainstem, and that's the final sort of driver for mortality in this patient population.
Just wanted to ask you a question. How does the investigator's findings that distinct subclones are primarily responsible for tumor expansion versus persistence over time affect potential future work for this group?
Well, I don't know for this group. My guess is they probably want to keep doing this and do it at a bigger scale and see if it's possible to incorporate this into other studies. I think this kind of an approach, if done, can really help inform what's going on in our early phase clinical therapeutic trials and see, like, why are we be successful, why are we failing, et cetera. It's a tough thing to be able to incorporate, but I think it'd be a great benefit for the field.
Well, these are very interesting and very forward-thinking in terms of how we think about our patients and their disease. And I really wanted to applaud all of the authors at such great work. Just to finish up, the last abstract that we're going to discuss today is the MDM2 inhibitor preclinical study of nivantamab, pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, and efficacy in glioblastoma IDH wild type.
Yeah, so this is a basic science study by the Mayo Group, and it ties in with actually a phase zero study that they had done earlier. And so they did preclinical work, then they did the clinical trial, and then they kind of went back to the lab and tried to sort out, like, what's going on, and able to see that they have the drug being able to get into the enhancing tumors in the preclinical models very nicely, but not into the non-enhancing tumors. And so that begins to sort of spell out, like, if you're able to get what you need, where you need to get it. And for me, it does raise the question of whether this is going to be an adequate approach because of the efflux pumps that push this drug out of the non-enhancing tumor, which is really where the progressive edge of tumor is. And where we're again saying that that's what drives, you know, down into the brainstem, and that's typically non-enhancing disease with no angiogenesis really seen on the microscopic evaluation. So I don't know, but it kind of gives you a gauge on whether this drug and others along this line are worth pursuing further, or do we need to combine them with things or figure out a way to get them in better?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting clinical approach to do the basic research work, clinical, and then take it back to the lab to kind of tease out the mechanism a little bit better. From your perspective, with about 10% of patients with GBM having this MDM2 amplification, how do you feel this is going to be potentially incorporated into the clinic for patient care?
Yeah, so I think my hope is that not just for this abnormality, but for other molecular abnormalities, that we as a group of treating physicians, that we are aggressive in performing molecular interrogation of our tumor samples in the newly diagnosed setting, in the recurrent disease setting, and doing it right from the beginning. And so that way we have a good gauge on what the incidence of these abnormalities is, and then, you know, are able to look for the appropriate clinical trial opportunities for these patients, that if something does demonstrate clear efficacy, that we can start the patient on that within the context of whatever the regulatory label indication is.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts are in terms of the symposium for 2025?
What's cool about the Clinical Science Symposium is that it gets sort of stimulated by the abstracts that come in. People take a look and say, hey, we can build a good story thematically around this, right? And I'm looking forward to being surprised and being in the audience and hearing what people have to present next year.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.